Well, good evening. It's time to begin our study this evening. For those of you that are visiting with us, I know we've got a few tonight. We're in a class on the historical reliability of the Bible, and in particular, we're focusing primarily on the New Testament, and right now we're focusing primarily on the Gospels. It's going to take us a while to get out of the Gospels because there's just that much good historical evidence for it. We are in our third class just dealing with external evidence, and we'll talk about something completely different tonight that we've not talked about yet. I guess that only makes sense. We don't want to talk about the same thing every week. That wouldn't be very productive. Sometimes you say something and then you realize what just came out of your mouth. So, well, we'll be looking at a different line of historical evidence for the reliability of the Gospels this evening. But before we begin, let's have a prayer together. Our good Father, we're so thankful to you for this day that we have, where we can come together and study about you and your Word that has been so reliably preserved for us. We put our confidence in you that you have given us your revelation, and you have preserved it for us so that we can come to know your mind and share in it that we may grow to be like you. Father, we ask that you would increase our faith in this series of studies, that our confidence would truly be in you and in your gospel and in your Son. And it's in his name that we pray. Amen. All right, to get us back on something of a roadmap of where we've been and where we're going. We've not been that far yet, obviously, since we're still in this first left corner of external evidence. But we talked about non-Christian sources to begin with, particularly as it relates to the genuineness of the documents, that they were written by who we believe them to be written by. We talked about a variety of incidental kinds of confirmations where from outside the Bible, various things that happen in the text are confirmed to be accurate, and those are not things that by themselves are overwhelming. You know, we talked about the fact that for a while people said there couldn't have been a King Herod because Judea was under Roman rule, but then they, you know, found, among other things, King Herod coins, which pretty clearly proves there were King Herods and other things like that. None of them is overwhelming by themselves, but as the pile just begins to build and build and build, it becomes very clear that these documents are written in a historically accurate manner. We talked last time in particular just about the book of Acts. We went through a variety of evidences for the book of Acts that it's historically accurate, talking about things like the names that the different regional leaders were called and how it was different from one city to the next, and Luke gets all of those terms right. His accuracy in regarding locations and ports and boundaries and even slang terminology, we talked about some, and that's where we left off last time. Today we're turning our focus to something else, and that is the names that are used in these documents, and that's going to wrap up this top left quadrant, and then we'll work to the right to the internal evidences, and we'll spend next time talking about the undesigned coincidences in the narrative, and that's something that I've talked about a little bit before in the past. We'll really unpack that a lot more. That's a really just fascinating argument, as far as I'm concerned at least, as is what we're talking about tonight, this name information. This is something that's a relatively new argument. The information has only been around and available since about 2003, was the first time that this stuff was really put together. Basically, what it boils down to is the fact that we have good evidence on what people were called, what Jews were called, in a variety of places around the ancient world. And that gives us an idea. If the documents are using the same names that people were actually called, that gives it the kind of air of authenticity to it, and we'll see how that all works out. But part of the reason why this is significant is because none of these documents were written in Palestine, with the exception of Matthew, which might have been. And this is not something that just skeptics say. I mean, if you read a skeptical commentary, a critical introduction to the New Testament, they're going to have them writing from all over the place because they believe they're written, you know, 100 whatever years later. But even if you go back to the early Christian documents, the ones that we were citing that said, you know, Matthew wrote Matthew, you know, 2nd, 3rd century documents, they have these documents being written from other places as well. So Matthew may have been written from Judea, but Mark was probably written from Rome. John was probably written from Ephesus. What the early Christians say about Luke is a little bit more wide in the dispersion. Some say Antioch, some say Achaia, some say Rome, but none of them say Palestine. So at least three of the four were written outside of the city of the land of Palestine, outside of Israel, and they were all written a quarter to a half century after the fact. Some 30 to 65 years later, they were written. Now think about this for a second, specifically in terms of forgers trying to pass off a fraudulent document. I mean, that is what's going on according to the skeptical position. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John didn't really write Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Some forger wrote it. They pretended to be people who were in close association with Jesus, and they're writing these fraudulent documents is what the skeptics believe. In another place, 50 years later. What are the odds that they can get all the names right? Let's say you're going to write a fake story. You're going to try to pass it off as history and fool a bunch of people. You're going to write a story. It's going to be set in France 50 years ago. What's the most common name in France 50 years ago? Anyone want to take a stab at that? Jacques, that's a good guess. Okay. Another good guess, maybe? Pierre? Oh, there's another good one. All right, we've got two names so far that probably were prominently used. Now, can you name 30 or 40 other names, some that are very frequently used, some that are not very frequently used? Use them in the right proportion and have the right kinds of characteristics to those names as well. Good luck, right? I mean, I can't imagine trying to do that, and yet that's what the skeptics say is going on here. But what we find is these authors were incredibly accurate in what they've done. And I mean, if you've never visited a place, if you've never been there, if you're making it up later, how can you write about it intelligently? I mean, these people are writing before Google existed. I mean, they couldn't go, you know, go down to the grocery store and pick up a magazine of the most popular baby names in the year AD 30 and find the people's names that are going to be used. This kind of stuff wasn't around. You either know it or you don't know it. You either have access to the historical information, you're either a witness or you're not, and this is not the kind of thing you're just going to make up. Now, in addition to that, you're trying to, you know, foist these stories about France 50 years ago off on people and make them think it's historical truth. Not only do you have to get the names right, you also have to get the geography right. You have to get the agriculture right. You have to get the architecture, the topography, the botany, the climate, the burial customs, and all kinds of other things right as well. Tell me about all that in France 50 years ago. Anybody want to go? I mean, I could give you an hour with the internet, and you probably still couldn't come up with all of that very easily. Yet this is the kind of thing that we will see the gospel authors are incredibly, incredibly accurate with all the way through. And names change frequency as well. That's something else that's pretty striking when you think about this. It's not like the most common name right now is the most common name for 30 years ago. And it changed probably more slowly, more gradually in ancient times than it does now, but they do change. And they're not the same from one location to the next, as we'll see as well. Charlie? Right. And something along those lines as well. I mean, one of the options is they all got together and colluded about this. I mean, it was a big conspiracy. But I mean, you think about that. You've got these people in different places around the Roman Empire getting together and making sure their name count is the same. You know, we all use Simon the same number of times and we'll use Mary the same number of times. I mean, it's ridiculous to think in that kind of you know, that's the sort of thing that's going on. So yeah, I mean, we've got our France scenario is one example. That's pretty tough. But I mean, even here, right now, what is the most popular name in Florida in the year 2015? I mean, that's one of those. That's a tough thing to know. I mean, you could look it up maybe, but it's the kind of thing that you know, even if you were living in the area, say Matthew's actually in Judea, maybe he has the ability to guess this, but in reality, your intuition about what the most frequent name is probably isn't right. And the reason that I know that is because every year, hundreds of people give their child some amazingly imaginative, original name, only to find out there's 10 other kids with the same name as soon as you name them. I mean, I didn't know any Silases until we had a Silas, and now they're all over the place. And that happens all the time, because we just don't really have a good feel for that as much as we think we do. And so then you add time to it, you add space, the distance from wherever they're riding back to Palestine, and this as well, the odds of them getting it right is just absolutely astronomical. Well, there's data from some 3,000 first early second century Jewish names. Some are from outside of that time as well, but most of them are from that time period. That are from things like papyri, various legal documents and other things like that, burial inscriptions on the ossuaries. If you remember, they would put the body in the tomb for a year, then go gather the bones and put it in a bone box or an ossuary, it's called. Lots and lots of those have been found with writing on them, names and things like that. Josephus, of course, lists a lot of names, as do other documents around the same time period. And what we wind up with is some 3,000 names. And what they found is that the Jews in Palestine had different name frequency than Jews in other places, very significantly different from the Jews in Alexandria, Egypt. There was a very large Jewish population in Alexandria as well. They didn't have the same names. So if you're in Alexandria, say, and you're trying to write about Palestine, and you're using the names around you, you're going to end up with the wrong kinds of names. So the most popular names, here's the 9 most popular names in Palestine. You've probably heard a few of these before. Simon, Joseph, Lazarus, Judas, John, Jesus, Ananias, Jonathan, and Matthew. The most popular ones in Egypt, Lazarus, Sabbatius, Joseph, Dosiphius, Pappus, Ptolemaeus, and Samuel. The reason why we don't have, you know, kids running around today named Ptolemaeus and Pappus isn't because they're funny-sounding names, but because the story of Jesus didn't happen in Alexandria. I mean, if Jesus was there and his apostles were Ptolemaeus and Pappus and Sabbatius, then those probably would have been names that picked up in popularity. But they didn't. And so you have different populations in different places with different names. The Gospels and Acts are written outside of Palestine, but they have the right names. Now, I'm not going to go through all the data tonight. That would just bore you to tears. It would bore me to tears as well, and I don't want to do that to you. But to give you a little bit of an idea of what's going on here, if you take the top 2 men's names in Palestine, the top 2 men's names were Simon and Joseph. In Palestine, that accounted for 15.5% of all people were either a Simon or a Joseph. In the Gospels and Acts, 18.2% of all men were either Simon or Joseph. If you take the top 9 names, the names that I just gave you, in Palestine, it was 41.5%. In the Gospels and Acts, it's 40%. And as you see, the sample size getting bigger, the margin gets smaller and smaller. And so you have just this incredible correlation between the names that are used in Josephus and the ossuaries and the other legal documents and things and the New Testament. In fact, however you break it down, Simon's the top name no matter what. It's the top name in the New Testament, top name in the ossuaries, top name in Josephus, top name in the papyri as well. And so there's just this incredible correlation of the names, which means not only do they have the right names, they're not naming their people, you know, Sabbatius or, you know, Marcus Aurelius or whatever else they might have named somebody. They're giving them the right names. They're also giving them the right names in the right proportions. The same thing is true of the women's names. Although the data is a little bit wider, there's a much smaller sample size of women's names. There's just not as much information about women's names. And I don't have a chart on it, but the top 2 women's names is 28% in Palestine, 38% in the Gospels and Acts. Those 2 names are Mary and Salome. The top 9 women's names are 50% in Palestine, 60% in the Gospels and Acts. So you've got about a 10% discrepancy there. But again, it's such a significantly smaller sample size, it's hard to know for sure. But overall, they get the right names in the right proportions. Now, something else that is just kind of interesting to look at along this line is why some of these names were so popular. why was Simon such a popular name in first century Palestine? Well, it's the same name as Simeon. So, I mean, there's a tribal connection there to one of the 12 tribes, but it's not like Simeon was ever a big tribe. I mean, Simeon, the historical Simeon, bad things happened with him back in Genesis. His tribe was never all that significant. You don't read about any famous Simeonites or whatever they would have been. So why Simon? Why is that so popular? Anybody want to take a stab at that? Simon the Sorcerer, well, that's one of the Simons that we read about. I don't know that he was well known enough to have been the cause of all the other Simons. What did you say, Jeremy?
The Maccabean leader.
Yeah, the Maccabean Simon was one of the big leaders of the Maccabees well back in the beginning. And once you realize that, what becomes pretty evident is that six of the nine most popular men's names were names of the Hasmonean dynasty. And some of the other names that were God-based names or Yahweh-based names are names that are focused somehow on national deliverance and restoration. Yahweh has been gracious. Yahweh is salvation. God has listened. One of the names just means comforter, and you think of the various comfort passages in the Old Testament talking about the coming Messiah. And all of these names are a reminder of the messianic fervor that's going on there leading up to the time of Jesus, and you see that there. In fact, it's kind of conspicuous that there are three very, very famous Old Testament names that are basically not used at all in Palestine. Those names being Elijah, Moses, and David, each of which has a messianic connection. Elijah the forerunner, Moses the great prophet like Moses that is coming, that they saw as someone who would be coming around the same time as the Messiah, not realizing it was the same person as the Messiah. Of course, David, the messianic king, the Davidic king that is coming. And, you know, we don't know if it's because they thought it'd be presumptuous to name their child that, but it does still seem to reflect that messianic fervor, kind of an ironic way that they're not naming their kids this. But everything seems to be pointing toward that. All right, well, what do you do with all of this? One thing that is also interesting to think along these lines is, how do you distinguish people? You walk out into the street one day and you say, Simon, hey, Simon. Like half the city turns and looks at you, right? Because everybody's basically named Simon, or maybe not quite everybody, but it might seem like that at times. So what they had to do is they had to disambiguate the names, to use a Wikipedia term for you there. You know, when you're there and you have to click the disambiguation button. That's what they had to do as well. And so they had various ways that they would disambiguate the names one from another. So you read through the Bible and you find Simon, who is called Peter, Simon the Sorcerer, Simon the Zealot, Simon the Tanner, Simon of Cyrene, Simon the Leper. And there were various ways that they made these kinds of distinctions. Same thing with the women. Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, Mary the mother of Jesus, and so on. And so they had various ways of doing this, and you see plenty of examples of this. So, for example, sometimes there are variant forms of a name. Zacchaeus is probably an example of this. Zacchaeus is a shortened form of the name Zechariah. Probably, we don't know, but probably either there was another prominent Zechariah around, or maybe his father or his grandfather, or both, was a Zechariah, and so he was given the shortened form of the name, and that became what he was known by. But that's an example of a variant form of a name, which would be part of this kind of disambiguation. Sometimes a father's name was added. So you've got Levi the son of Alphaeus, John the son of Zebedee, those kinds of things. Sometimes, instead of the father's name being added, the father's name was substituted. You read about Bartimaeus in Mark chapter 10. In fact, in Mark it says Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus, which is a grand redundancy because Bartimaeus means the son of Timaeus. But probably what's going on there is Mark, who is writing for a Roman audience, they don't speak Hebrew. They don't know Bartimaeus is a reference to his dad, and so they clarifies what's going on there for them. But this is a case where his name was probably something else, Bartimaeus, and Bartimaeus is what stuck. It's kind of like sometimes people become known by their last name. The family name becomes their name. That happened to me when I was at Florida College because I was one of six Nathans at Florida College, in a small student body. There were three of us on the same floor of the same dorm, and so it had to be last names. Same thing seems to be what's going on here. Sometimes the name of a husband or a son is added for a wife. So Mary of Clopas in John chapter 19 is referred to by her husband, the mother of the sons of Zebedee. Sometimes it's kind of a roundabout way of getting to James and John's mother. She's called that at one point. Nicknames are added sometimes. So you've got John the Baptizer as opposed to all the other Johns. James the Less or James the Little, depending on how you understand that word. Simon the Leper, who obviously wasn't a leper anymore because Jesus is having a meal with him. Maybe one of the guesses is that Jesus had healed him. That certainly would make good sense of what's going on there. Sometimes a place of origin is added. I skipped one ahead of myself. First of all, nickname is substituted sometimes for a name. So Simon, who is called Peter, ultimately just becomes Peter. Or Cephas sometimes. Joseph, who is called Barnabas, just becomes Barnabas, and we only know them by the nickname at that point. The place of origin or their dwelling is added sometimes. Mary of Magdala, you know her as Mary Magdalene. Simon of Cyrene, Jesus of Nazareth, all of those kinds of things are done at different times. Sometimes you got names in two different languages. You read about this fellow named Silvanus at the beginning of Paul's letter sometimes. You're like, who on earth is this Silvanus guy? I've never heard of him before. Well, that's the Roman, the Latin form of the name Silas. It's just the same name in different languages. Same thing's going on with Paul. I can't tell you how many times I heard growing up that Saul was converted, and he was so converted, and he wanted to show the world how converted he was, that he changed his name to Paul. That is just incredibly inaccurate. Because after he's baptized for like three more chapters, the narrative keeps calling him Saul to begin with. So that should be your first clue that that's not what's going on. And then also he starts being called Paul when he gets to Gentile territory. Same kind of thing as Silas Silvanus is Saul and Paul. It's also been suggested that Andrew might be a case of this. Andrew's a Greek name. You would figure a good Jewish boy growing up in Galilee with a brother named Simon would probably not be named a Greek name. And it may be that what was going on is he had another very common Hebrew name, and the Greek version was Andrew, and that's just what stuck, and the Greek version was substituted for the Hebrew version, but we can't know for sure with him. Sometimes the occupation is what becomes the key indicating factor. So Simon the Tanner, for example, Simon the leather worker that Peter stays at his house. And there are a few other ways that that's done. Those are kind of the big ones that you're probably very familiar with happening in the Bible. Now, what you might not realize is that these names showing up like this don't just happen haphazardly. It's not just that every now and then one of the authors says, hey, you know what? I'm going to tell somebody who this guy's dad was. That's a random piece of trivia I think they'll find fascinating. Or it'll sure be interesting to find out that this guy's a leather worker. What happens is every time someone has a prominent name, a top 10, top 20 kind of name, the disambiguation is added. And every time they don't have a highly frequently used name, it's not added. The reason why is because when you walk out on the street and you say Simon, half the city turns around. When you walk out on the street and you say Thaddeus, one guy looks at you. You don't have to clarify when the name is Thaddeus. You do have to clarify when the name is Simon. And the New Testament does that incredibly accurately. Not only do they have the people named the right names, they're named Simon and John and Judas instead of Ptolemaeus and Sabbatius and those things, they're named that in the right proportion. The number one name in the Bible is the number one name in the other documents. The number five name is the number five name, and it's very close. Top ten in both is very close. And then they have the right features. They know who needs to be clarified and who doesn't. Here's an example of this. Over in Matthew chapter 10. Spend at least a little bit of time reading the Bible tonight instead of just talking about it. This isn't an exegetically profound section of text, so I hope there's no desire for great theological depths here. Matthew chapter 10 and verse 2. The names of the 12 apostles are these. First, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew, his brother. James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother. Philip and Bartholomew. Thomas and Matthew the tax collector, James the son of Alphaeus and Thaddeus, Simon the Cananean, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. So going through this list pretty quickly, we've got Simon, first of all, number one ranked name. We have a qualifier, Simon, who is called Peter. We have Andrew, who has a little bit of a qualifier. His name is not a frequent one, but he is being introduced in relation to his brother, the most famous of the apostles, and so that's probably why that qualifier there is there with him. James is the 11th most common name, another very high-frequency name. He gets the qualifier, the son of Zebedee. John, another high-frequency name, 5th most common, has the qualifier, his brother, also the son of Zebedee. Philip, 61st most common name, not common name, no qualifier given. Bartholomew, 50th most common name, not common name, no qualifier. Thomas, less than 80th. He doesn't even show up on the charts that Bauckham has in his book. Not a common name, no qualifier. Matthew, 9th most common name, very high frequency. Matthew the tax collector, you get the qualifier for him. James, again, 11th most common name, qualifier, the son of Alphaeus. Thaddeus, 39th most common name, not common, no qualifier. Simon, back to number one, frequency name, high frequency qualifier, the Cananean. Judas, 4th most common name, qualifier, Judas Iscariot, and also qualified as the one who betrayed him. Now, this is information, again, that we've really only had access to since 2003. So it's not something that, you know, it'd be easy for scribes way back when to kind of doctor this. It's not something that's easy for the gospel authors to get together and say, all right, let's look through our documents and we'll all compare the name frequency that we have and put it all together. There's a video where Dr. Peter Williams, someone, a British scholar, goes through some of this information as well. And he goes through this not only in terms of the name frequency, but he divides it out by proportion. The number of times the names are used per thousand words. And you see how even more closely they all correlate with one another. And it's just absolutely remarkable. How does this happen? Well, you've got a couple of options. One, they all got together and conspired together and counted the words of their documents and made sure they all had the same names and the same frequency with the same characteristics in proportion per thousand words. Or they got really, really, really lucky. Or they were just telling what they saw happened. And they were eyewitnesses, and they're reporting what happened, and they have the right names and the right frequency because they were there. They describe people the right way because they were there, and they know that's how people talked about people in that time. You also find the same sort of thing happening in dialogue as well. So Matthew 14, if you want to flip over a few pages. We've got a high-frequency name, John. This is the story of the death of John. And what you find happening in this, I'll tell you at the outset so you can look for it, is in dialogue, in a crowd kind of situation where you can't just say John, it is clarified which John it is, John the Baptist. But when the narrator is telling you, the reader, who are already aware of what's going on, it's not clarified. And so in dialogue and crowd situations, these names are always clarified. In other situations, they're not. So Matthew chapter 14, verse 1, at that time Herod the Tetrarch heard about the fame of Jesus, and he said to his servants, "This is John the Baptist. He has been raised from the dead. That is why these miraculous powers are at work in him." So he's talking to his servants. He doesn't just say, "This is John," because if he'd said, "This is John," they would have said, "Which John? Who are you talking about?" So when he's talking to them, he has to say John the Baptist. Now, you are already aware of who is being talked about. That point has been clarified. So as the narration goes on, in verse 3, "For Herod had seized John," he doesn't have to tell you which one, you know who, "and bound him and put him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because John had been saying to her, 'Is it not lawful for it is not lawful for you to have her?' And though he wanted to put him to death, he feared the people, because they held him to be a prophet. But when Herod's birthday came, the daughter of Herodias danced before the company and pleased Herod. So he promised with an oath to give her whatever she might ask. Prompted by her mother, she said, 'Give me the head of John the Baptist here on a platter. And so she clarifies John the Baptist because, you know, if she just says, give me the head of John, she might end up with the wrong head on the platter. And that would be unfortunate for the other poor John who got his head chopped off and for Herodias who doesn't have her anger salved. Well, too bad for her, I guess. But so he sent and had John beheaded. So every time it's clear to you, the reader, who it is, it's not clarified. Every time it shows up in dialogue where it needs to be clarified, it is. You find the same thing happening with Jesus. In speech, it's Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus the Rabbi, Jesus who was called the Christ. You go through the Gospels, and we won't take the time to do that, but if you did, that's what you would find over and over and over in all of these documents. Yet, when the narrator just is talking, he just says, Jesus. Because, I mean, you're reading the Gospels, and if you don't know who Jesus is, you've got bigger problems to begin with. But when they're reporting direct dialogue, they report it accurately the way that it would have been said with those kinds of qualifiers, because they had to be qualified in those kinds of situations. Charlie? Yeah, and that's the case where it's probably he was called different things. He was also Simon the Zealot, so it's just something to distinguish him. And he is among the apostles. There are two Simons. There's Simon Peter and Simon the Canaanite, or Simon the Zealot. And he probably wasn't always Simon the Canaanite. It was different ways of describing him in different kinds of contexts, but he had to be described somehow. But yeah, you're right. If he was in his homeland, then there's a whole bunch of Simons of that homeland.
So if you're hearing this, how would you know who they were talking about?
Well, I think some of that is answered by the audience of these Gospels. I mean, these are presumably being read by Christians who know who the apostles are. And so you're reading about the 12 apostles and, Simon the Canaanite, you're not like, oh, which Simon the Canaanite? It's the apostle Simon the Canaanite.
So basically you have to know this.
I think in this context, I think that's it. And in a different kind of context, he probably would have been distinguished otherwise. If it was a broader audience where that wouldn't have been helpful, then he might have been Simon Bar, whoever his dad was. Simon Bar Simon, probably. Or whatever it would have been. So, Jeremy, were you going to say something? No? Okay. And so again, you've got the option, how does this all happen? Well, it could be a very clever literary device to make the narrator look like they know what they're doing, or it could just be that they're reporting what's happening. And this is something that's remarkable, and this is something that Dr. Williams talks about that I think is just a really important point to make. And that is, let me ask it this way. How many of you have a hard time remembering names? Yeah, basically everybody, right? I mean, you can remember everything about everybody except their name sometimes. I mean, how tall they are, you know what color hair they are, what their kids look like, what their job is. You can describe everything about them from top to bottom, except their name is right there on the tip of your tongue and you just can't get it and it's driving you crazy. That's probably happened to you in the last week, maybe, that kind of situation. It's because there's no logical connection between a person and their name. I mean, stories are easy to remember. Names are hard to remember. And what Dr. Williams says about it that I think is just very profound, and we've got to think through the ramifications of, is that if the Gospels have correctly got the detail that's the hardest thing to remember, then isn't there every reason to think that they've gotten everything else right as well? If they get the names right, and they get the names in the right proportion, and they get the names with the right frequency, and it's correct in dialogue and in narration, the way that it would have been used then, if they get all of that incredibly difficult information right, then shouldn't we trust that they have the story right? Because we all know that the story is a lot easier to remember than the names. And you know that not only from your experience of people that you know. You go watch a movie, and there's this third, fourth, fifth level character that has a very important role in the story. Plays a very significant function in the plot development. But you walk out of that theater and you have no idea what that character's name was. You know exactly what they did. You have no idea what their name was. You might not even remember the lead character's name sometimes after you watch the whole movie. The story is easy to remember. The name is hard to remember. The Gospels get the names right. So even, I mean, if you're looking at this apart from the doctrine of inspiration, still you should have incredible confidence that they get the story right based on the fact that they get the names right. And it's not just individual names either. They also do it with place names. So we're going back to our story of France 50 years ago. How many cities in France can you name to make this up? How many cities in Florida can you name if you're going to write a fraudulent story about Florida and get all of the geography and topography and botany and travel times right? They know how long it takes to get from one city to another one. Imagine making that up in a different country and getting it right. And it's just incredible. I mean, the Gospels, they have 23 cities and villages among them all together. Jerusalem is mentioned 66 times. Nazareth is mentioned 21 times. Capernaum is mentioned 6 times. Bethany, Bethlehem, Bethsaida, Jericho, Sidon, and Tyre are mentioned between 5 and 12 times. Enon, Arimathea, Bethphage, Caesarea Philippi, Cana, Chorazin, Dalmanutha, Emmaus, Ephraim, Magadan, Nain, Salem, and Sychar are all mentioned 1 to 4 times. So you've got 23 different cities in this region mentioned. And there are some pretty big cities, like Jerusalem, the capital of the region. You figure that one's going to show up right. But Bethphage? I mean, what do you know about Bethphage? I mean, let's say you're writing your gospel, your Mark, and you're writing your gospel in Rome, and you're making up this fraudulent story, of course, because that's what all the skeptics believe that he did. And he wants to try to make his story accurate by using the right place name. So he goes to the most authoritative library that he can find and gets books on cities. And all those books tell him all the wonderful places he should go before he dies, like Ephesus and Corinth and those kinds of things. I guarantee you, none of them are going to mention Bethphage and Cana in their lists. And so you're not going to be able to make this kind of thing up. And not only do they know the names of the cities, again, they know details about them, things like geography and topography, climate, travel time, which cities you go up into, which cities you go down into, where there are rivers, and all of those kinds of things as well. And this is one of those places where in that video, the proportion is incredible. Basically, they're identical in proportion per thousand words, the number of cities they got right. And, how on earth do you do that? You know, Luke calls up Mark and says, hey, how many words are in your gospel? Well, he counts them up. Okay, well, how many city names are in there? Okay, well, I'm going to write my gospel, and I'm going to make sure that my city names per thousand words is nearly identical to your city names per thousand words. I mean, really, is that what we think happened? It's far more reasonable to say they each just reported the history that they saw or the history they learned about, and this happened as a natural result of that. Also, some of the details they get right in these places. In Luke chapter 19, we read of Zacchaeus, and Zacchaeus is in a sycamore tree. You know why Zacchaeus climbed a sycamore tree? The answer is kind of given away. What's that? Well, so he could see. Yeah, so, you know, pragmatically, he climbed the sycamore so he could see Jesus. But why is it a sycamore tree that he climbs?
He didn't. It
wasn't a sycamore. Well, it was a fig sycamore. It's a variety of sycamore, not a sycamore like we have here.
Well, they didn't know what a sycamore was over there.
Right.
It misidentified it. I'm a botanist.
Yes, I... Well, this kind of tree that is called a sycamore tree in the Bible has a very specific range of where it grows. And it grows down in Africa, and it grows up in Palestine, and those are the only places that it grows. And it grows in Jericho, where Zacchaeus was climbing whatever tree it was that he climbed. And that's a remarkable thing, because if Mark is writing in Rome, and John is writing in Ephesus, and Luke is writing in Rome or Achaia or wherever, they've never been here. They wouldn't even know what kind of tree it was to begin with, to use the correct Greek word for what that tree was. You've got to be there and know what the botany is in that place in order to name the right kind of tree that he climbed. Tom?
Okay. And that's where we get that name.
Okay, so
why we call the sycamore here a sycamore, I have no idea.
Okay, so the Greek word is sycamore, but it's a fig tree that is being referred to here.
But there's two kinds of fig trees. This was a sprawling one that he could climb out on easily.
Right. Yeah, and it's not this kind of fig tree is not everywhere. That's the point I want to make more than anything is this kind of fig tree is very limited in where it is, and so to write intelligibly about it and know that it's there, you have to have some kind of information to that. You're not just going to make that up. I mean, back to our story in France, tell me what kind of tree someone's going to climb in France to get a good view of Jesus. Oak? I don't know. I mean, you can guess, but the odds of getting it right, you know, is pretty slim. One other example of this is in Mark and John. This is the feeding of the 5,000. In Mark chapter 6 and verse 39, we read about this. There's this big crowd. Jesus wants to feed them. He commands them to all sit down in groups on the green grass. Now that's a strikingly strange little detail for Mark to include, that the grass was green. Well, if you know anything about that region, you know the grass is not green all the time because there are very long dry periods. So Mark includes the fact that the grass is green, which is an interesting detail. Well, when you go over to John, in John chapter 6, where John tells the story of the feeding of the 5,000, a couple of interesting points here. First of all, he says, now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. And then down in verse 9, Andrew comes with the boy and says, there's a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many? Well, a couple of details that they know and have accurate about what's going on here. You know, if I pulled a Palestinian precipitation chart, what you would see is the Passover happens right after like the 6 rainiest months of the year. It's Passover time. The grass is absolutely going to be green at that time, at that place. Also, the Passover is right after the barley harvest. This boy has barley loaves. And so again, you're getting these little incidental details right that they know because they know the region really, really well. And again, if the Gospels have correctly got these little minor, very difficult to get right details correct, isn't there every reason to suppose they get the hard stuff right, or the easy stuff right, the big stories right? All right, any questions or comments here? Yeah.
I can see if he was trying to make that point that he said, well, this is fabricated. Well, he includes that detail because he's making it up, but he has a reason for including that detail, and as you say, it really would have been made at that time of year. So it's,
yeah. And the massive crowds as well is probably part of this. I mean, it's Passover time, so you've got thousands of people traveling to Jerusalem. And so there's another reason, that something else that fits in the narrative as well as to what's going on. Well, one last thing we'll end with in our last couple of minutes here, and that is how this all compares with the apocryphal Gospels. Because there are all of these other Gospels out there that are floating around that skeptics say, well, these are just as good as your Gospels. They should be included. Why is the church trying to suppress these things? All of that sort of Da Vinci Code nonsense that you hear from time to time. Well, how do they do with this? Well, in the Gospel of Thomas, the lead character is Didymus Judas Thomas, which means Twin Judas Twin, which is not the sort of thing that someone would have been named. What it shows is someone that's not really familiar with what's going on trying to give someone a name. There's a Mary that's mentioned, but we don't know which Mary it is. There's no clarification as to who it is. There's a Salome that's mentioned. That's the second most frequent woman's name. There's no clarification on her. In the Gospel of Mary, Jesus doesn't even have a name. He's just called the Savior. There's another Mary, but again, we don't know who she is. In the Gospel of Judas, was pretty famous a couple years back. Well, in the Gospel of Judas, you've got Judas and Jesus, and then a bunch of heavenly figures with bizarre names like Barbello and Nebro and Yaldabaoth and Soklos and Harmathoth, and on it goes. So, I mean, you've got two legitimate names and then just a bunch of bizarre names of, I don't know, aliens or something going on in that story. So it's not compelling. Same thing with place names. We've got 23 cities and villages with incredible information and knowledge about those cities in the Gospels. Each of the canonical Gospels has 14 to 16 cities or villages listed in it. The Gospel of Philip has two, Jerusalem and Nazareth. The Gospel of Peter and the Gospel of the Savior each have one city, Jerusalem. And the other 13 second and third century Gospels have zero cities mentioned in them. So all of them together have two cities, Jerusalem and Nazareth. Jerusalem is the most populous place that there was. Everybody, it's kind of like if we're writing our story about France and we get Paris right. A big deal, you got Paris right. That's kind of what Jerusalem would have been like. And the Gospel of Philip that mentions Nazareth, it thinks that that's Jesus' middle name. So that really doesn't count. So really we have one city name right in all of the apocryphal Gospels, and it is the city of Jerusalem, the capital of the whole region. When you look at these apocryphal Gospels, people say, why don't you treat these like you treat the canonical Gospels? And it's very, very easy to answer. Because they're a bunch of made-up garbage. It makes a very compelling case. It's not a compelling case against the Gospels. It's a compelling case for the Gospels. You want to know what made-up fraudulent stories look like? Look at the Gospel of Philip and the Gospel of Judas. That's what made-up fraudulent stories look like. You want to know what true eyewitness, high-quality testimony looks like? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Brother Winton?
How much can we trust the Maccabees?
As historical documents, from what I understand, they're pretty good historical documents. I've never studied the books of the Maccabees in a whole lot of depth. Tom, you want to...
Seems like it's
yeah, it's very sober kind of history. It's not, you know, outlandish mythologizing like you find in some of these apocryphal Gospels. The Old Testament Apocrypha is very different from these apocryphal Gospels.
Well, Maccabees,
yeah.
They do not claim to be scripture. Or there is no prophet among the people, so
yeah.
It is just history.
Yeah, it's intended to just be history. And it's intended to be an accurate history as opposed to these apocryphal Gospels, which are pretty clearly fabrications and falsehoods written 200 years later. Again, that's what the skeptics say about the Gospels, but you see what that actually looks like in these apocryphal Gospels. So you got a couple of options when you talk about the Gospels and their accuracy. You know, maybe they were incompetent and they messed it all up. Maybe it was a conspiracy and they're very, very clever. Those two things are mutually incompatible, but that's not what you see in the documents themselves. What you find, again, is high-quality eyewitness testimony. All right, next we'll start talking about some internal evidence. We'll leave this external stuff behind.